So let's continue with the discussion that we began last time. I will start with a recapitulation of some of the ideas covered in the previous lecture. I think, even though I hope they were clear, they're actually more difficult than they might at first appear, and it's worth reiterating them as a way of setting up the next part of the discussion. So first, just to remind you, the ideal of democracy. The ideal is that in a democracy, all decisions which affect our common fate and common interests should reflect the collective will of equal citizens rather than powerful elites. There's a lot of complexity there. It's common will and common interests. Well, what's the distinction between common fate and common interests? Well, not every aspect of our fate we hold in common, and not all of our interests are in common. How do we draw the distinction? Well, that's something that has to be decided collectively. And it should reflect our collective will of equal citizens. Well, there's two bits in that little expression. Equal citizens, as opposed to unequal citizens. And somehow, this equality of citizenship, these citizens, people who are equal in their political standing, have to form a collective will in order to decide what to do about their common fate and common interests. All of that is terribly complex, and it should be thought of as an ideal to which political institutions aspire. The test of an institution, therefore, is not whether it fully embodies this ideal, but whether there are impediments to that ideal which are unnecessary, which can be removed, whether the ideal can be better reached by changes in the way particular institutions are organized. Well, underlying this ideal is a value, is an underlying value, which I think for most people is pretty uncontroversial in contemporary American society and similar societies. This idea of self-determination, that all people should have broadly equal access to the necessary means to participate meaningfully in decisions over things which affect their lives. That's what self-determination means. You should be able to make the decisions that affect you without asking permission from others. Autonomy, self-determination. Rather than having your life controlled by others, you should be in control of your own life to the greatest extent possible. But there's a problem that immediately arises with that value. If we really believe in self-determination, we immediately encounter a really tricky problem. And it's a problem for which there is no perfect solution. There's only practical solutions, which may be good enough. The big problem, if you believe in self-determination, is that many of the things that you choose to do autonomously to affect your own life also have consequences for other people. In your intimate relations in your family, when you're making some important decision which affects other people, you typically, or I think at least the principle is one should typically consult the other people. You shouldn't make big decisions that affect the other people's lives in your family without them being involved in the decision. Certainly in a partnership, in a marriage, in a close, intimate relation, if somebody is going to make a big decision that affects the other person, they should be party to the decision. Now, how you negotiate that, how you figure it out, how you weight the preferences of different people, how much you talk it through, how much you try to reach a consensus, well, that's always difficult and always a problem to be solved. But there is always this difficulty. If you believe in self-determination, some of the things you decide to do as self-determination affect others. And in principle, if those effects on other people are substantial, the idea of self-determination implies that they should be part of the decision as well. You should not be able to impose significant consequences on the lives of others without their consent, without them at least being participant in the decision. Well, once you recognize that there's this tension between self-determination and autonomy as a value applied to your individual life, and self-determination as a value applied to everybody, not just you, you face this problem of deciding when do you need to consult other people and when don't you? When do you need institutions for that consultation? I mean, after all, it's just not practical for every decision you're making that affects other people to check out all the other people individually who might be affected. Once you recognize that that's a problem, you have to create an institution for that consultation. That's what we call democracy. I mean, that's the hardcore value underlying democracy. That there are important decisions to be made which affect all of us, not just individual persons. And when those decisions need to be made, everybody should be involved to the greatest extent possible. And this is why I argue that the value of freedom, which Americans hold dear, and the value of democracy, which I think most Americans believe in as well, although perhaps not quite as deeply as they believe in freedom. Typically, freedom kind of trumps democracy. That wasn't meant to be a pun. That's going to be a problem in our current era, that the word trumps is a common word used in various contexts, and whenever somebody says it, of course, it will invoke the president, and therefore people will wonder, are you making a joke or are you just using the word? I was just using the word. So self-determination both includes freedom of individuals to make choices that affect their own lives as separate persons, and their capacity to participate in collective decisions which affect their lives as members of a community. That's the same value. It's not different values. It's the same value. It's the same value, but in different contexts, and those different contexts are often in tension. And it's often very difficult to figure out, well, which decisions should we allocate to the collective decision-making process, and which decisions should we allocate to individuals? That line of demarcation is the distinction between the public and the private. Or at least that's one way of talking about what that distinction is. And this can get immensely controversial. One of the raging controversies of our era is about reproductive rights of women. Rights over your own bodies. Well, that's, for many people, seems like a very clear, bright line. That's a line of demarcation. Whatever else is true, you should have autonomy in making decisions about your own body. Other people shouldn't tell you what to do with your own body. You should have control over your own body. That seems really foundational to the idea of autonomy and self-determination. But some people interpret pregnancy as no longer a woman's own body. One interpretation of pregnancy is that there are two bodies involved. And because there are two bodies involved and you can't consult the fetus, the community has a right to prohibit certain kinds of interventions of a woman over her own bodily reproduction, her own biological reproduction. Well, that's immensely controversial. Is that part of the private domain of a person, or is it part of the public domain of the community? It's a hard question for many people. For other people, it seems just obvious one way or the other. One of the big controversies of our times. Another controversy of our times, which is perhaps less controversial because the controversy has been shunt aside, has to do with private property. Should you, because you own a business, be able to just close it down and move it elsewhere, even though that has immense effects on other people? Is that private, a private act, where you only have to consult yourself? Or is it a public act, as a member of a community, which affects the lives of others, and therefore that decision should be regulated by public debate, public decision making? Well, that's a difficult and deep question. It's at the heart of debates over how much regulation of a capitalist economy is desirable, how much is permissible by some principle of public versus private, and which is better for the well-being of people. Big controversies over that. If the decision is made, as it has been, that such decisions really are just the private decisions of individuals. If you own something, you have the right to sell it. You have the right to move it. That's what owning something means. Whether it be owning your car or owning, you know, some jewelry or owning a business. The word owning means the same thing in all those cases. And therefore, you're not exercising public power when you move your investments abroad. You're simply exercising private autonomy. Whereas other people argue, as I would, that this is such an exercise of decision-making that affects the lives of other people so pervasively that it should be subjected to public regulation. The public, the collective, the community should be able to decide on the trade-offs between the private advantage of individuals seeking to maximize their own interests and the public consequences for the lives of others. That trade-off, which is a real trade-off, shouldn't be just left up to individuals. But again, that's a controversial claim. So, once you recognize that underlying democracy is the concept, the value of self-determination, and you understand its deep connection to individual freedom, everything gets complicated. It's no longer a simple matter to say what should be left up to individuals and what should be part of the collective decision-making of a democracy. All right, so that's the ideal of democracy and the underlying value. The reality of democracy, and this is everywhere, this is not an American issue. So here we're speaking abstractly about the concepts themselves, about the nature of this problem. Actual democracies operate under significant constraints which undermine the democratic ideal. That's the kind of sort of fundamental institutional problem. We have the ideals, we have the underlying value, but then we actually build institutions with particular rules, and those institutions are going to operate under constraints which have the effect of challenging or undermining or constraining the democratic ideal. And the question then of a sociological character, and the question which we'll be addressing when we get to the more empirical parts of this part of the course, is exactly how do these institutions operate, and are there ways in which the constraints on democracy could be made weaker. Constraints vary in their intensity. You can have a democracy in which these constraints, in which these constraints are very damaging, and others in which the constraints are less severe. I then described two broad categories of constraints. So first, the idea of constraint, a constraint on democracy. That's a way of asking the question, why is it that our democratic institutions do not fully live up to the democratic ideal? I'm using the term constraint to describe the processes that exist in the society which put restrictions on how democratic a democracy is. And there are two broad categories of constraints that we discussed, which I referred to as the demand constraint and the resource constraint. Of these two, I think the demand constraint is the more difficult one to really get your head around. The resource constraint is pretty straightforward. The demand constraint is a bit harder. The demand constraint says this. The demand constraint refers to restrictions on what people are prepared to demand from the government. What the demand constraint helps to explain is why the political demands that get raised in the political sphere, when we debate candidates, when we think about party platforms, when we look at all the different things that happen politically, The demand constraint refers to the ways in which things are going on in the society which limit the range of demands that get made, that restrict what people want to achieve in government, through democratic processes. The demand constraint helps us to explain why certain demands are at the center of politics and others are on the periphery, and some things might be completely silenced. And what I emphasized in that idea of the demand... The principal demand constraint that I focused on was this idea that in a democratic capitalist economy, when we have this particular combination of institutions in the state, in politics, and institutions in the economy, whatever you want to accomplish in the government needs to be compatible with a good business climate. You can't make proposals that will have any credibility that people will listen to unless they're also good for business. That's the basic idea, that you have to ask the question of every policy, of every demand, it has to pass the test. Is this compatible with the interests of investors? We don't have to ask the question in the same way, is this compatible with the interests of children? Or is it compatible with the wealth, with the sustainability of the environment? We first ask the question, is it good for business? Is it compatible with the interests of business? And then we can ask the question, is it also good for children? Or is it also good for the environment? That's what a demand constraint means. Your demands get narrowed down by the requirement that all public policies sustain a good business climate. The resource constraint refers to the fact that different social groups and individuals, social categories in the society, have different resources which they can bring to bear in pursuing their political demands. Politics depends not just upon enlightenment, not just upon good argument, it also depends upon resources. The resource constraint then reflects the fact that the private resources which people accumulate in their private lives are usable politically. That we have not created any institutions that are effective in excluding the capacity of people to translate private power into public power. And that undermines this fundamental idea of equality of citizens. Some citizens, simply by virtue of their private resources, are able to have bigger political influence than others. And that's fundamentally undemocratic. The democratic ideal is that decisions are the result of the collective will of equal citizens rather than powerful elites. Well, to the extent that powerful elites, meaning people who are powerful by virtue of their private resources, that powerful elites are able to influence politics to a greater extent than ordinary citizens, then that principle of democracy is violated. If that principle is violated systematically and pervasively, many people say that we have shifted from a democracy rule by the people to a plutocracy, ruled by the plutocrats, basically by elites. And that's one of the big criticisms of contemporary American democracy that one sees, that in fact there's been a steady erosion of the equality of citizens with respect to their capacity to act politically, and that we have drifted from a democracy, however imperfect, we've crossed a line where it really isn't plausible to say that it's ruled by the people any longer. It's a plutocracy rather than a democracy. It is sometimes argued. That's the resource constraint. It's a more straightforward kind of argument than the demand constraint. Well, I want to now turn to two examples of the way resource constraint operates. And then I want to discuss one possible institutional innovation that might weaken the resource constraint, might make some difference. We will discuss these issues much more deeply in the more specific parts of the subsequent lectures when we talk about elections and other aspects of democratic institutions. Okay, so first, the free rider problem, our old friend, the free rider problem. Well, just to remind you of what the free rider problem is, free rider problem occurs whenever there's a situation in which pursuing your own interests in a rational way ends up hurting your own interests, not just those of other people. This happens but the context in which this can happen is when there's some kind of goal which requires cooperation with other people. It requires collective action, not just individual action. And people are tempted to let other people do all the acting, the collective acting. They're tempted to sit on the sidelines and let other people make the sacrifices. Now, this problem only kicks in when participating in the collective action involves some kind of sacrifice. You know, there's no collective action problem in playing sports, because if you enjoy playing a sport, then sitting on the sideline isn't as much fun. It's not as enjoyable. So you want to cooperate with others and get into the action because that's what makes playing the sport enjoyable. So sports do require cooperation. It is a collective action. You're a team sport. You're not just playing it by yourself. You're playing it with other people. But sitting on the sideline doesn't give you any advantage. You don't want to be a bench warmer. You want to play the game. So there's no free rider problem in getting people to cooperate to play the sport. Well, that's different if you have various kinds of political goals. If you have a political goal that requires people getting together and cooperating and engaged in protests or engaged in canvassing for elections or even engaged in voting, it requires cooperation from other people, in which people are paying a cost when they cooperate. People are paying a cost when they cooperate. In the next lecture, we'll be discussing elections. And it's actually a bit of a puzzle. Why does anybody ever bother voting? Why bother voting in an election? When you think about it as a collective action problem. So just to foreshadow the issue, which we'll be discussing in the next lecture, it takes some effort to vote. It's not costless. Even if you do early voting, you still have to get your ballot and fill it out and send it in. It takes some effort to vote. In some contexts, it takes quite a bit of effort. You know, we've seen cases where people had to wait in line for hours to vote because of the lack of adequate numbers of polling stations, right? So it takes a lot of effort to vote. What's the probability that one vote will decide an election? Well, in big national elections, presidential elections, the probability is just vanishingly small to zero. Even in the 2000 Florida election, in which the president election was decided by a couple hundred votes in Florida, it still was a couple hundred votes. It wasn't one vote. So if you ask yourself the question, it's going to take me a couple of hours altogether to vote, you know, by the time you go to the polling place, and in many cases, it takes a couple of hours, you have to register, all this sort of thing. It takes time and effort to vote. It takes some time and effort to get informed enough to know who you want to vote for. The probability of my voting making any difference in the election is zero. It's just not going to happen that the presidential election is going to be decided by one vote. Therefore, if I stay home, the outcome is going to be the same. it's simply not going to make any difference whether I vote. The outcome is going to be the same whether or not I vote. I guess I'll just sit home because I don't want to take the trouble. I still want other people to vote because I might care about the outcome of the election. But I'm not going to bother. Well, you can see, that's a classic free rider problem. It's a classic free rider problem because if everybody behaves the way I behave, then democracy collapses. Right? So you can't, if you sit home because you don't want to make the sacrifice to vote, but you want everybody else to because you actually do believe that it's better to live in a democracy than to live in some other form of government, you're free riding on other people's sacrifice. And of course, if everybody did what you did, then the system would collapse. But of course, many people do vote. And so it's a kind of interesting question. Why do people bother voting? Why do they bother voting? Since it's irrational to vote. Irrational in this narrow sense. You're expending effort that has no consequence. One vote doesn't count. You know, when you see advertisements at election time that says every vote counts, the proper expression is that all vote counts. Of course, they all count. But does every single vote count? Well, in fact, if you take one vote away, it's not going to make any difference. Well, this is a paradox for which there are solutions, good solutions. That's the problem we'll discuss next time. Okay, that's the free rider problem. The free rider problem is especially important when we come to questions of public goods. A public good is something which broadly benefits everyone, or nearly everyone, and in which the consumption by one person doesn't exclude the consumption by another. That's what a public good is. Democracy is a public good. Democracy benefits nearly everyone, but it requires a lot of sustained voluntary contribution of activity to function democratically. So democracy is a public good in the sense that it benefits you whether or not you consume it, whether or not you're a participant. It still benefits you to live in a democracy rather than in a dictatorship, even if you sit on the sidelines. But it's a public good that's produced by voluntary contributions of activity by people. And a free rider problem threatens public goods. Free rider problems make it harder to produce public goods. So this is the basic problem for the free rider problem in democracy. Democracy requires very high levels of energetic voluntary cooperation among people in order for democracy to be really democratic. It requires high levels of energetic voluntary cooperation. People have to be willing to join together for political purposes. The free rider problem potentially makes this difficult. And then here's where the resource constraint kicks in. It's easier for wealthy people, people with lots of resources, to overcome this problem. There are easier solutions to the problem of free riding if you've got a lot of money than if you don't. So why is this the case? Why is the free rider problem more difficult for ordinary citizens to overcome than wealthy citizens? Well, here's the kind of argument, step by step. The efficacy of individual action is low for most people. The impact of your individual action is quite limited. That's clearest in the voting case. Voting for a national candidate, the efficacy of your action, that is your decision to vote, has very, very little consequences. If your own actions make little difference and if it is costly to participate in a democracy, then why bother participating? Again, that's the standard free rider question. For very wealthy people and corporations, their individual action, and especially their money, is likely to make a bigger difference, and therefore they are more likely to feel it is worth the trouble to engage in political activities. The key issue here is how much of a difference in the probability of a favorable outcome is my action likely to make. The Koch brothers donate millions of dollars to the Walker campaign in the recall election. Millions and millions of dollars. Ordinary citizens individually decide whether or not to make a campaign contributions, but they're very limited in amount. And what individuals are deciding is whether they are going to make campaign calls if they're actively involved, canvass on behalf of the election, or simply to vote. The range of options open to individuals are much more limited and make individually a much smaller difference. The Koch brothers, on the other hand, could ask themselves the question, is it worth $10 million for our interests? What's the return on this investment if we oppose the recall of Walker in 2012, when that recall election was held? The calculation for a wealthy person is basically depends upon their willingness to pay. And the willingness to pay for the very rich is less demanding than the willingness to act for the average person. The willingness to pay is very less demanding, especially for giant corporations. This and very wealthy people. It doesn't affect their consumption at all. The standard of living of the Koch brothers did not decline by anything when they contributed tens of millions of dollars against the recall campaign. For those of you from Wisconsin, I think you're probably old enough to have some memories of the tumultuous political situation here 8 years ago, 7 years ago. No, 6 years ago, 2011, at this time when the state capitol was occupied for 17 days and there was an effort to recall the governor. In November of 2011, public opinion polls indicated that a significant majority of people were in favor of the recall. I think it was 52 or 53% were in favor of the recall and 40% were opposed. There was a significant margin in favor of recalling the governor following the protests earlier in that year. In order to have the recall, the opponents of Scott Walker had to gather roughly 1 million signatures, a very big task. They had to gather signatures equivalent to 25% of the vote. 500,000 signatures, I think they were required. 25% of the vote in the previous election. They gathered close to 1 million signatures, more than twice what was needed. The problem they faced, however, was this, that once the recall was validated, they had to pick a candidate. So they needed a primary election to decide who would be the candidate to run against Walker. And then they needed resources to actually run the campaign. The opposition to Walker had a few million dollars available for their advertising. I believe the figure for Walker was something in the vicinity of $40 million, substantially from the Koch brothers. The opposition to Walker decided to withhold using their limited contributions for advertising until they had a candidate in the spring of 2012. Whereas the opposition to the recall began advertising against the recall relentlessly starting in late 2011. They had 3 or 4 months of ads opposing the very idea of a recall before ads in favor of the recall began appearing. The imbalance in funding was so great that it was essentially impossible for the opposition to Walker to mount a campaign that would simultaneously, that would both be able to have advertising for the particular candidate when the election occurred, and mount a campaign opposing, defending the idea of a recall. Well, this in any case is the is my analysis of what happened in the course of the campaign. In when the actual election occurred, Walker was reelected. That is, he survived the recall election by, I think, a 53 to 47% margin. I think that that outcome was substantially the result of the willingness to pay of the backers of Scott Walker, which turned out to make a bigger difference in the outcome than the substantial willingness to act for the people opposed to Walker. There's substantial willingness to act being indicated by the level of energy it took to have over a million signatures for the recall. Well, that's the essential structure of the way the resource constraint plays itself out in the mundane politics of a democratic society, where it makes it easier, the resources available privately make it easier to get around the free rider problem when all you have to do is donate money to translate your interests into politics compared to having to donate your time. Now, many people do donate their time, don't get me wrong. The level of participation of people who care and are willing to do canvassing and calling and all the other stuff, attend meetings, all the other stuff of politics, there are many people who do this. But it's always experienced as a significant burden. It takes time away from other things that most people would rather do. Contributing money when you're extremely rich, and especially contributing money when you're a rich corporation. You're a rich corporation that has a huge bankroll, and you can contribute now unlimited funds to politics. Corporation is now legally a person, but it doesn't have feelings. It doesn't have private needs. It simply has resources. Well, the donating of money to politics from corporations creates this gigantic imbalance in dealing with the free rider problem, which is, again, more intense for ordinary people. All right, another aspect of this problem is what political scientists have called rational ignorance. This is another kind of free rider problem. It's certainly another form of the resource constraint. Rational ignorance. That's a kind of bizarre expression. How can it be rational to be ignorant? Rational ignorance. I mean, if it was called rational stupidity, it would seem even more ridiculous. Rational ignorance. Here's the basic argument, and then why this affects politics. Information is necessary for politics, but information is costly. This is similar to an issue we discussed at the very beginning of the course. Remember in the discussion of markets, market exchange, one of the problems in ordinary functioning of markets is information. That markets are only efficient, just ordinary consumer markets, it's only efficient if you have good information about the things you're purchasing. Markets are not efficient. They don't produce efficient outcomes if consumers have very poor information about the qualities of the things they're purchasing. That's why we have all sorts of rules in place against false advertising, right? An advertiser can't claim legally, I mean, they often do, of course, they can't claim legally that their products have certain properties if they don't. They're required by law to avoid fraud in their advertising. They can go right up against the truth, they can make claims about the wonderful qualities of a product, how it's going to make you feel. They can associate the product with sexiness or with other, you know, glamorous celebrities or whatever, and seduce you into buying it, but they can't tell you an absolute lie about the properties of a product. Nevertheless, it's a big problem for people to get information about the products they consume. And people are prepared often to spend quite a bit of the time and effort to get good information. That's why we have things like consumer reports, all sorts of information sources. People research alternative reviews of smartphones before they buy a smartphone and so on. Well, this is a general problem, that information is costly. And the question people ask is it worth investing the time and effort and resources needed to get good quality information? That's true for markets, it's also true for politics. Are the benefits of good information greater than the costs of acquiring high quality information? You know, if you're taking a simple rationality point of view on this, for any choice you make, you ask, are the costs greater than the benefits? If the costs outweigh the benefits, it's not worth doing. The answer to this question for political information for most citizens is no. For most people, the benefits of getting really good information, of being deeply informed about the issues, their implications, the underlying the consequences of different choices, to get really high quality information about political matters, for most people, it just is not worth the cost of time, effort, and money to get high quality information. And there are two reasons for this. First, the cost of good information for most people are pretty high. You know, most people don't have good research skills. They're not intellectuals. They don't have the particular training to track down good information, to differentiate good from bad information. The cost of good information for most people are pretty high. And secondly, the ability of most people to make much of a political difference using this information is very small. Again, if the costs were high, but... Oh, plug in another power source. I thought I was plugged in. No, I'm not plugged in. Okay. This is a problem we can solve. Good. So as I've been arguing, the ability of most citizens to make a political difference using this information is pretty small. So for the Koch brothers, it really does pay for them to get good information. You know, they and various other centers of great wealth, they devote quite a lot of information figuring out who are the politicians that are going to be on our side and who are going to harm us, whose policies are going to be best for Coke Industries and which policies are going to be harmful to Coke Industries. They're prepared to spend a lot of resources because they can use that information. They can decide where to contribute and where not to contribute in ways that matter. For ordinary citizens, however, the costs of good information are high. They don't have a research staff to do it for them. And the ability to make a political difference is small. Therefore, for most people, the most rational thing to do is to get information at zero cost. But zero-cost information is of poor quality. What is the most common zero-cost form of information politically? It's ads on television. During campaign season, why do political ads matter? Political ads have virtually no serious content. There is rarely serious discussion or presentation of policy positions and explanation for why those policies are important in ads. Particularly in the form of what's called attack ads. Attack ads have the character of trying to raise the emotional temperature around a particular person and to create negative feelings and views of the person as such, not of the issues. By virtually everyone's account, I think, the free information you get on television in the form of political advertisement is extremely low quality information. It's free, doesn't cost you anything to get it. You get it as a byproduct of watching television. But it's extremely poor quality information. The conclusion then is, it's rational for most people to remain ignorant about political matters, but remaining ignorant leads to a set of political choices that are grounded in emotional appeals, symbolic politics, rather than informed understanding of the real trade-offs and issues involved in our collective life. That's rational ignorance. I'd like to discuss a partial solution to a case of rational ignorance, to a particular circumstance, which I think is pretty interesting, and it involves an institutional innovation that I think has considerably broader implications. So here's the case. On the west coast of the United States, as I think some of you, maybe most of you know, there is a common practice in elections of having ballot initiatives. A ballot initiative is a proposed law, so it's just like a bill that would go on in the legislature, but which is subjected to popular vote. Sometimes I'm sure heard the term referendum used as well. Initiatives and referendums. These are two kinds of ballot measures. The technical difference between an initiative and a referendum is that in a referendum, the thing that is put on the ballot has been put there by a legislature. So for some kinds of laws, you need to put the proposal on a ballot for people to vote on. But it would be a city council or a state legislature or a school board that would put the measure on the ballot. So when we have votes for bond issues to build new public schools, those get placed on the ballot not by citizens signing a petition to put it on a ballot. They get put on the ballot by a city council or some other governmental body. That's a referendum. A ballot initiative is a law that's placed on a ballot through some regularized process, usually it's signing petitions, by ordinary citizens. Some states allow it, some states don't. Wisconsin does not allow it. The Wisconsin Constitution does not have a provision in it for ordinary citizens to organize a petition campaign to place a ballot measure on the ballot for citizens to vote on. On the West Coast, all three states, Washington, Oregon, and California, have initiative provisions in the state constitution, which get used extensively. There are often dozens of issues that voters need to vote on a given election. And these are substantive issues. One of the most famous in California is something called Proposition 13 back in the 1970s. That proposition limited property taxes, tremendously put constraints on the ability of jurisdictions to raise property taxes. And the result was a catastrophic decline in funding for public education, for K through 12 schools in California. California went from having what were broadly considered among the very best public schools in the country to among the very worst in the course of two decades because of this dramatic restriction on the ability to raise taxes to pay for schools. And that was the result of an anti-tax initiative back in the late 1970s. I'm not sure exactly when that passed. But there are lots and lots of other initiatives in all of these states. There is a very famous case, well, famous for people who study such things, in Washington 10 or 12 years ago, maybe longer by now, you know, time flies, in which there were two propositions for ergonomic safety in the office. Ergonomic safety refers to things like, you know, the nature of the chairs you sit in and the arrangement of furniture so that you don't get back problems or carpal tunnel syndrome from the way you type and so on. So there was an ergonomic safety initiative, two on the ballot. One was to strengthen the ability of the state to regulate offices in favor of ergonomic safety, and the other was to weaken the power of the state to regulate offices. They were both called something like ergonomic safety initiatives. They had slightly different names, and they both passed. Right. Well, how could this be? How could you have two initiatives arguing the opposite and have them both pass in the same election? Well, the reason was it was very confusing, and the information people had available was lousy, confusing wording and misinformation on TV ads. Because of our very strong views about freedom of speech, there is no regulation as to what you're allowed to say in a political ad on in a campaign. You can say outright falsehoods in political ads, and there's nothing you can do about it. There are libel laws. If you accuse somebody of having an affair in a political ad and they didn't, and you could prove that this was slander, it's conceivable in the courts years later you could win a judgment that this was libelous. But basically, there's no mechanism in place to prevent political ads from telling outright lies. And that includes in these initiatives. And it's a huge problem. Citizens are completely confused about these initiatives. They get bombarded with television ads. The ads are paid for typically by special interests that have resources to spend a lot of money on ads. And it means that what on the face of it looks like a pretty democratic idea, citizens can vote directly on laws that affect their lives. I mean, that surely seems to embody the equal citizen view, because after all, it's one vote, one person. A referendum and initiative seem very democratic. But the democratic process gets all scrambled up because of misinformation and the rational ignorance problem. That is, it's tough for individual citizens. You got 15 initiatives on the ballot. How are you going to figure out how to vote on each of them? Well, Oregon has instituted an extremely interesting solution. It's called the Oregon Citizens Initiative Review. The Oregon Citizens Initiative Review. I'm going to show you a brief video, if I can manage the heroic task of getting, let's see if this will do it. That won't do it. Let's try this. You would think that the technology would make this easier than it is, but here we go. All right, now, of course, the next question is, are we going to have sound? Once again, no sound. Oh, here. All right, we will get sound. Maybe by the end of the semester, you'll have the illusion that I'm confident about these things.
It will all be worth it. It is essential to Oregon review to what their government is about.
Here, I'm going back to the beginning.
Oregonians are using this shit more as a citizen than any other state. It will always be with us. It is essential to Oregonians' views of what their government is about, their sense of democracy.
We love the admission process, but yet there are
flaws, boundaries, or oftentimes complex, confusing, hard to understand what the long-term impacts on. We've seen a number of different initiatives kind of have back and forth with the legislature. Too often, there have been cases where people, after the fact, have just been like, we didn't know that's what it was, or the whole buyer's remorse issue. Citizens Initiative Review brings together a cross-section of we the people, if you will, who work on figuring out what these measures are all about, and then helping to inform their fellow voters. The final panel is balanced by age, party affiliation, location of residence, gender, ethnicity, education, attainment, and then voting, which is how many elections we voted in the last four.
I'm guilty of being swayed by ad one way or the other, and I know that's wrong now after seeing how skewed the information is from either side.
We have a chance to hear from advocates for the measure and advocates against the measure, a range of background experts.
I think, like many organizations, when I get that voters' pamphlets start putting through the measures, it just becomes daunting because there's just so much information, much of which is just propaganda, and it's really hard to figure out who's telling the truth, who's not. Right. I think this process helped me figure out how to do that.
Five days, talking to experts, reviewing all the material, taking all the information and putting it in one source for voters to review, and I think it'll help people make a more informed decision.
I think it really helps that a diverse group of citizens have taken time to go through the information to figure out what's important and state it in a clear way so that voters can really use that information to inform their vote.
It's easy for people to be really despairing about politics because of how divisive things are. And I think what's different about the Citizens Initiative Review is it's not like that. It really is to be together to work on a common agenda. I mean, you can see it in the process when after several days people sit up and take notes, and even if they have different views, they're able to work together in a way that I don't think you see in other politics today at all.
They will understand that they can take back the process. That system is not working. You've never seen a CBS campaign after going through the whole process. Because I'm sitting there going, that's not better.
I really think that if every Oregonian had an opportunity to do this and took that opportunity, that we'd be like the smartest voting population in the nation.
There are a lot of reports that's not accurate. In fact, the vote passed on the initiative process itself is that initiative advocates take a closer look at the measures that qualify for the ballot and keep this process in mind, knowing that there's especially a public hearing. This is the national first. Nobody's done election reform in this way to date, so there are a lot of eyes on this to go to the city. People pick up on what we've done in their home state.
I wish more people could go through this process because I think we're going to appreciate the whole process of voting. It really makes me mad when people say, oh, my vote doesn't count, you know, because it does.
You can do it. There we go. So the basic idea of the Citizens Initiative Review is the following. It was explained in the video, but let me give you the a more general characterization. If you can get a random set of ordinary people and pay them pretty well so that it's worth their time to participate in the process, and have them review the arguments for and against each initiative. Have them meet and discuss. So it's not just that they listen to experts on both sides. They're really like a jury, which then discusses the matters. They have their own autonomous deliberation over the information that they receive from experts and advocates on both sides of these initiatives. And their task then is to try as best as they can to formulate a consensus, if they can, and if not, to have a kind of majority and minority report where they lay out the arguments as they, as ordinary citizens, have come to understand them, the best arguments on either side of the issue. Then their report is distributed to ordinary voters, to the broader voting population. What that means is that ordinary voters now have a cheap source of information, which they can reasonably regard as high quality information. You can ask yourself, well, if a group of people just like me deliberated about these matters, this is what the report would be. It solves the rational ignorance problem not by having the government create a set of public interest ads in which experts hired by the government present the arguments, but rather the government organizing a forum in which a random sample of voters deliberates and comes to their conclusions, which they then share with the broader population. It's kind of like you're simulating what it would be like if everybody participated in such a discussion. If it were truly a random group, then it would be pretty much the same if whatever the random group would be. And so it kind of simulates what a broad, deep, public-informed discussion would be like. Well, that's not practical. The costs and the practical impediments to doing it in a way in which everyone was directly involved in that deliberation isn't practical. So this is a kind of clever institutional end run around the problem to create these citizen review panels, which are trained in how you deliberate. They get some training in the process of discussion. They hear testimonies. They deliberate themselves, amongst themselves, checking out, how did you understand this? What do you think? Having back and forth dialogue, and then producing a report. Well, I think this is a really interesting idea. It takes a particular component of our political system, which is usually seen as playing an extremely limited role, that is the jury. Right? So what's a jury in the English-American tradition? A jury is a randomly selected sample of citizens who are supposed to be the peers of a person accused of a crime. You're judged by a jury of your peers, people just like you. Well, what a jury consists of then is a deliberative body, a body which discusses the issue and comes to a decision based on the best information available, information provided by the prosecuting attorney and the defense attorney, in which it's their responsibility to weigh the information and come up with a consensus. They are exercising power, which has been delegated to them as equal citizens. So the jury is an interesting idea. It's really direct democracy, ordinary people exercising the power of the state, not professionals. You don't sign up to be a professional jury member. You're randomly selected. Of course, there's all sorts of problems with juries because sometimes it's not so random. We've had histories in the United States where certain categories of people were excluded from juries. In the South, African Americans were excluded from juries. We had all white juries convicting African American defendants. There's all sorts of potential ways in which a jury system collapses, fails to represent the equality of citizens. But the ideal is a practical one, And there really is no reason why you can't have juries play a broader role in various kinds of public democratic processes. And this particular role in the Oregon Citizen Review is initiative review. This particular role is, well, let's have a jury help solve the problem of rational ignorance. So if you have initiatives on the ballot combined with a citizen panel that evaluates the pros and cons of the arguments and shares that with fellow citizens, then the citizens who vote are no longer subject to the problem of being vulnerable just to the propaganda on the television. They're inoculated to some extent from that by having available this high quality information. Of course, they have to read it. And it's been an issue in the Oregon process and an issue that's evolved over time, how to encourage people to actually take seriously the Citizens Initiative Review, right? So it's true, this is a good source of high quality information, but it has to be consumed by people. It's my understanding that I believe this has been going on now for 8 years, something like that in Oregon, that over the different election cycles, the proportion of voters who actually read the pamphlet that gets distributed with this Citizens Initiative Review statements, the proportion that actually read it has been steadily going up. And one could hope that over time, then this would become a really deep and organic part of the electoral process. We will discuss in the next lecture, is on elections, which turn out, I think, to be just an extremely interesting and perplexing aspect of democracy. The idea of how can you organize a democracy in which you have free and fair elections that are actually fair, right? What does it mean to have a really fair election? But we'll discuss one extremely interesting proposal at the end of the lecture next time. So this is not in the book. This is something which I've become involved in studying since the book. The idea of in a state like Wisconsin, where we have two elected chambers, right? We have a state senate and a state assembly. What do you think if we just scrapped one of the two and replaced it with a randomly selected citizens' assembly? So we still have two chambers, but one is like a jury. You know, we have a legislative assembly just made up of ordinary folks who are randomly selected, paid extremely well, and they function as citizen legislators. They're not elected, but they're deeply representative, because they are randomly selected from ordinary citizens. And you have a two-chamber system which argue with each other. One is elected by party politics, through party politics. The other is selected through random sortition, it's called. Well, we'll discuss how that could be a way of constraining the role of money in politics by creating a independent citizens' assembly that is not subjected to that kind of resource constraint in the same way that an elected chamber is. That will be at the end of the lecture on Thursday. And we're done a couple minutes early, so I'll see you then.